Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this evening's seminar. I'm delighted that it's the first seminar for the Hellenic Observatory for this academic year. For those of you new to the Hellenic Observatory, then just to give you a signal that we regularly have research seminars like this every 2 weeks in term time, and they are normally Tuesdays at 6 p.m. and they have been so for many years. So please do look at our website for information about upcoming events. We have different kinds of events, not only the seminars, but some public lectures coming along. And I'll perhaps say something more about that at the end of this evening's session. And we give a very warm welcome to our speaker this evening, Jorgos Alekos-Koufis. He's a very good friend of the Hellenic Observatory, and I'm proud to say he's a very good friend of mine. And we're very pleased to be welcoming him back to the LSE. The LSE is his alma mater, where he did his PhD in economics. More than that, George has spoken at the LSE and has given talks to the Hellenic Observatory at least 250 times, I think. So it's great that he's accepted the invitation to come and speak to us again this evening. You know George Alekos-Koufis. Let me remind you of his academic work. Of course, he's one of the best Greek economists of his generation. He's written very extensively. He's a professor at the Department of Economics at the Athens University of Economics and Business. He's a former head of the department. Since 2009, he's been a research fellow with the Hellenic Observatory. Thank you for that. And he is a fellow of the European Economic Association. For three academic years, he held the Konstantinos Karamanlis Chair at the Fletcher School at Tufts in the United States. And of course, as almost everyone of you will know, from 1996 to 2009, he was a member of the Greek Parliament, and from 2004 to January 2009, he was Minister of Economy and Finance. His academic output has been extensive. He's published 7 books and over 50 journal articles in some of the top academic journals in economics, including the American Economic Review, the Journal of Political Economy, the Economic Journal, etc., etc., etc. His most recent book, Dynamic Macroeconomics, a graduate textbook, was published in 2019 by MIT Press. This evening, George will address us with the topic, the twin deficits, monetary instability and debt crises in the history of modern Greece. He will argue that the determinants and implications for Greece of the twin fiscal and current account deficits throughout the history of modern Greece. His analysis will focus on the determinants and dynamic interactions between the twin deficits, domestic monetary regimes, and access to international borrowing. Throughout its 200-year history, modern Greece has been characterized by prolonged periods of low economic growth, monetary instability, and sustained fiscal and external deficits. Current account deficits have been a consequence of the shortfall of domestic savings relative to investments. And after the 1970s, the main driver of fiscal deficits has been the attempt to redistribute income and wealth and create a welfare state in the pursuit of greater equality. So there's a very large topic for us to consider, and of course we will have plenty of time for questions and answers afterwards. Just before passing to George, can I just make a couple of housekeeping announcements? For those of you who wish to use Twitter, we suggest the hashtag LSE Greece. And also let me say that this event is to be recorded and hopefully we'll make it available as a podcast available from the Heineken Observatory web pages, so you can share that with your colleagues and friends as well. But we look forward very much to the presentation, George, and welcome back.
Thank you very much. Okay, thank you very much for the kind words and the invitation, and the congratulations, of course, to you and to the new Eleftherios Venizelos professor who is here with us. So this presentation is part of a larger project on the economic history of Greece, which is something that I have been working on and researching for many years, but mainly in the last 3 or 4 years. And hopefully this will be part of a book on an English language book on the economic history of Greece and the state and the economy of modern Greece. So let me I don't know how this works. I can move the slides.
It worked for me if it goes, sorry.
Give you a very short account of what I'm going to talk about. Now, what are the twin deficits? The twin deficits are essentially two deficits. One is the fiscal deficit, which is the difference between the receipts and the expenditure of the government. And the second deficit is the current account deficit, which is the deficit in the current economic transactions of a country. That is the difference between receipts and expenditure in from the rest of the world. So these are the twin deficits. Now, the twin deficits have been a major characteristic of the Greek economy throughout its history. So the fiscal and the current account deficit have been, you know, permanent fixtures of the Greek economy. They have been so the fiscal balance, as we call the fiscal accounts and the current account balance, have been persistently negative. That is the way in deficit throughout the history of modern Greece, and they have been associated with long periods of fiscal instability, monetary instability, sovereign debt crisis, inflation, and I would also argue with periods of lower investment and low economic growth. There have been exceptions to this. The main exceptions were the 1950s and the 1960s. These were the only two prolonged periods, or this 20-year period, if you like, was the only prolonged period for which the problem of the twin deficits did not exist. It was addressed effectively. And as a result, during that period, Greece enjoyed probably the best period for its economy, very high economic growth, low inflation and absence of external crisis. In all other periods, the twin deficits had one of two effects. When Greece could borrow internationally to finance the current account deficit for relatively easily, it accumulated a lot of external debt. And eventually, sooner or later, it faced a sovereign debt crisis or a default. There were periods when Greece could not borrow internationally because it was excluded from the international financial markets. during those periods, the only thing that the government could do is borrow from the central bank. Now, while borrowing from the central bank means that essentially you go to the printing press and you print money. At the end of the day, this resulted in inflation. So in periods when Greece could not borrow internationally, it faced very high inflation and persistent inflation. In periods where it could borrow internationally, sooner or later, it faced a default. So large fiscal imbalance. Now, why did Greece have those twin deficits? For two reasons. First of all, the current account deficit is a reflection of two other deficits. One is the fiscal deficit. That is, if you have a high fiscal deficit, you also have a high current account deficit. And the second deficit is the imbalance between the savings of the private sector and investment of the private sector. So throughout its history, Greece had very low savings relative to its investment needs. So it had a private deficit, which resulted in a current account deficit. And it also had a public deficit in many periods, because the government had to spend a lot of money for defense or for wars or for redistribution of income. That was mainly the 1980s. And then it had a high fiscal deficit as well. So I will go through the various episodes, starting with the Greek War of Independence, because Greece started even before the Greek state was recognized internationally. Greece, the Greeks who were revolting against the Ottomans were borrowing internationally. So I will start with the War of Independence. So I will leave some of the theory behind us. I will go very, very quickly over the debt crisis in the history of modern Greece, and then we shall go into the details of every debt crisis. The first period where Greece borrowed from the rest of the world was to finance the War of Independence. So there were two independence loans, one in 1824, and the second one in 1825. Those loans were raised in London. I will talk about them in detail. Of course, Greece was not even a country at the time. It had a government, it had a provisional government who was sort of managing the revolution. But why the British capital markets lent to Greece is one of the big mysteries, but they managed to raise a lot of money. Of course, they could not service the debt, so they defaulted in 1826. You know, 2 years after the first loan, there was the first Greek default. Greece had no foreign exchange, no receipts, nothing. They were still fighting the revolution. The revolution was not going very well in 1826 as well, so they defaulted. What were the consequences? That Greece was excluded from international capital markets. They were not able to borrow again. And eventually, these independence loans were restructured and settled in 1878, which allowed Greece to return to international capital markets. So that was the first episode. Then there was a second episode. Despite the fact that Greece was not able to borrow internationally, when the protecting powers of Greece imposed King Otto as the monarch in Greece, the protecting powers that guaranteed Greece's independence were Britain, France, and Russia at the time. they imposed King Otto as a king, and King Otto was the son of King Ludwig of Bavaria.
Yes.
And his father insisted that, okay, my son will become the king of Greece, but you should give Greece 60 million French francs as a loan, so that my son can sort of set up the Greek state. So Greece borrowed 60 million French francs. Again, a very poor economy. After a war of independence, there was no way that they could service the loan. Also, there was a lot of, much of this loan was spent on a Bavarian regiment that was sent to Greece to keep law and order. So there was a default in 1843. This loan was with a guarantee of the protecting powers, the guarantee of Britain, France, and Russia, and that's why Greece could get this loan. There was no way that it could get it without the guarantee. The result of the default of 1843, which was the second default, was again that Greece was excluded from international capital markets, and also the protecting powers started intervening in the internal affairs of Greece. There were two blockades, one in 1850 and then another one in 1854, 1857, by the British Navy, on the pretext of, essentially it was to stop Greece from intervening, from attacking the Ottoman Empire during a Russia, a war between Russia and the Ottoman Empire. But the pretext was that Greece was not servicing its loans. There was a debt restructuring finally of this second loan in 1864. And then there was a period of external. So these are sort of very strange loans that were essentially given for political reasons. And so these are not typical periods of borrowing. However, after Greece returned to the capital markets in 1878, it started borrowing again. So between 1879 and 1892, Greece borrowed a lot from international capital markets in order to fund infrastructure investment, which was essentially the railways, by the governments of Harilaos Trikoupis, who was a reforming prime minister at the time, and also to bolster its defense capabilities, to fund the army. Throughout the history of modern Greece, from independence until the Asia Minor disaster in 1922, the main driving force of the Greek state was the so-called grand idea. What was the grand idea? The grand idea was to liberate all areas around Greece that were inhabited by Greeks but were still under Ottoman rule. That was the grand idea, because the original Greek state after the War of Independence was a very small Greek state. It was essentially the Peloponnese and the Cyclades and the central Greece. But there were many Greeks living in Thessaly, in Epirus, in Macedonia, in Thrace, in Asia Minor, and the grand idea was that all these Greeks should be liberated from the Ottoman Empire. So Greece had to, the protecting powers who had guaranteed Greece's independence were not very keen on the grand idea. Why? Because one's interests were against the interests of the other. So essentially Britain did not want Greece to pursue the grand idea for the fear that it would weaken the Ottoman Empire and help Russia come into the Eastern Mediterranean. So Britain did not want Russia to come into the Eastern Mediterranean. The Russians wanted to also help the Slavs living in European in Europe, in the Balkans, essentially. So it was not clear that the grand idea was compatible with the interests of the protecting powers. And France was usually siding with Britain in the 19th century. So Christie don't have a very good army. It could not pursue the grand idea. What King Otto was doing to promote the grand idea in the 19th century was essentially they were helping the Greeks who were living in the Ottoman Empire revolt. So the Cretans were revolting all the time, the inhabitants of Crete, which was in the Ottoman Empire, and people in other areas of the Ottoman Empire were revolting. However, after 1879, Greece started creating an army, we're talking about, but a lot of this spending was through borrowing, because there was not enough money to raise an army, okay? So there was a period of borrowing between 1879 and 1892. However, during an international financial crisis, there was a default. So Greece, Harinos Trikoupis, who was the prime minister at the time, said, we cannot service our external loans. And then there was a bailout by the protecting powers in 1898, but the protecting powers imposed very harsh conditions on Greece through an international financial commission that said you have to reduce your budget deficits, you have to stop creating inflation, you have to put your house in order. So there was an adjustment program in 1898, which was very successful because it caused a shallow recession. Then the Greek economy recovered, and Greece was able to enter the international gold standard in 1910. So it was a very successful stabilization at the time. It was easier to stabilize an economy at the time because it was easier to reduce budget deficits. There were no permanent government expenditures like in the latter part of the 20th century. So that was the third default in 1893. The fourth default happened in the interwar period after the Asia Minor disaster. After the Asia Minor disaster, Greece was essentially the economy had collapsed essentially. And at the same time, Greece had to welcome 1.5 million refugees from Asia Minor through the exchange of population between Greece and Turkey that happened in after the creation of modern Turkey. Kemal won the war in Asia Minor, and there was a treaty in Lausanne which provided that all the Ottomans, the Turks would, that lived in Greece would go to Turkey, and all the Greeks who lived in Turkey would go to Greece. Now, in order to welcome those refugees and to resettle them, Greece had to borrow again. From 1914 until 1926, it could not borrow. So Greece borrowed again in order to integrate the refugees and to improve its infrastructure. It stabilized its economy. It entered the interwar in gold exchange standard, which was a system of fixed exchange rates between Britain and between the British pound and the dollar, essentially. So the drachma became a part of the international gold standard, or the gold exchange standard of the interwar period. But then that system failed Britain left the system in 1932, Greece left the system in 1932, and it defaulted again on its debt. So there was, that was the fourth default. It abandoned the gold exchange standard, it introduced capital controls. Then throughout the world, there were capital controls throughout the world in the 1930s because of the instability of the international financial system. So Greece did not do something which many other countries did not do. It was not an exception. And then the final debt crisis is the recent debt crisis of 2010 and the bailout. This came after a period of very high external borrowing before and after euro area participation because of the fall in interest rates and the high debt that Greece had accumulated during the 80s. It was the first victim of the debt crisis in the Eurozone. And as you know, I will not say too much about this. I will come maybe towards the end. There were adjustment programs which were supervised by a Troika. The Troika was like the International Financial Commission of 1898. The Troika of the European Commission, the ECB, the European Central Bank, and the IMF. This stabilization program was not as successful as the one of the early 20th century. It caused the Great Depression in Greece. 25% of GDP was lost during this adjustment. But at the end of the day, the crisis ended. Greece continues to be part of the euro area under enhanced surveillance. You know, there's more interest in Greece than other euro area economies in Brussels. So these are the debt crisis. Okay. So I will talk about those debt crises in some more detail in the remainder of my talk. Okay. But before I go to the debt crisis, let us see what happened when Greece had deficits but could not borrow internationally. When Greece had deficits and could not borrow internationally, it had high inflation. Now, this is the evolution of inflation in modern Greece from 1833 until 2021. Now, if you look at the 19th century, this is zero here, zero inflation. Now, that's the line of zero inflation. In the 19th century, there were ups and downs in inflation. There was 1 year of inflation, another year of deflation. 1 year, so there were, inflation was not a permanent problem. It was, the price level was more or less, okay, some years you had high inflation, some years you had low inflation. Inflation became a problem when? After the Balkan Wars, after 1913, inflation rose during the First World War, like in the rest of the world. Wars are usually associated with a rising in inflation in every country, because most countries will finance wars partly through the printing press, through issuing money. So there was a rise in inflation in during the First World War. Then Greece had this Asia Minor campaign. There was another rise in inflation, very high. It was a period when Greece could not borrow internationally, because during the war, you could not borrow internationally. Then inflation was tackled after the economy was stabilized in 1926. Throughout the interwar period, inflation was relatively low, but then after the German occupation, Greece experienced a hyperinflation in the Second World War. A hyperinflation that persisted even for many years, even after the liberation, because Greece experienced a civil war after the liberation, so it was very difficult to stabilize the economy. However, so the inflation of of the occupation I cannot put in the diagram because it was in the stratosphere. So I cannot keep it in the diagram because everything else will go out of proportion. But you can see the inflation rises above the diagram and it comes back to the diagram in 1946 or 1947. Then Greece in the 1950s and 1960s had very low inflation. It participated in the Bretton Woods system of fixed exchange rates. It had no need to borrow internationally because there were no fiscal deficits and no external deficits. However, after 1973 and the first oil shock, inflation also rose again. It was tackled in the 1990s, so inflation gradually fell in the 1990s, and since then, Greece is part of the Eurozone, and inflation is not a problem. Okay. So in periods when Greece could not borrow internationally, like the First World War and the Asia Minor campaign and the Second World War, inflation was a problem. So one of the conclusions that comes out of this historical examination is that if you can borrow internationally, you end up sooner or later with a sovereign debt crisis. If you cannot borrow internationally, you end up with inflation. Okay, so this is the story. Now the reason is why did Greece have the twin deficits? It had the twin deficits first of all because in the 19th century and until the early 1950s, Greece was a very poor economy, so there were not enough savings in Greece. The Greeks could not save. So private savings were not enough to finance investment. And the second reason is that because of the grand idea, until the 1920s, Greece had the need to maintain very high defense expenditure, which created budget deficits. All right, so this is the story. Let me go and look at some of the details now. Because, if you look at history, the details matter. So let me go and look at the details. The War of Independence. Now, this is a picture which is in the Greek Parliament, showing the Greeks declaring independence in 1822. All right. Now, what happened during the War of Independence? Now, during the War of Independence, it is very surprising that the Greeks had a provisional administration which had rules. For example, in 1822, they voted a constitution which was democratic, allowed for individual rights, provided for how Greece is going to be governed. That was during the war. Okay, the constitution of Epidaurus is a place where there's an ancient theater in the Peloponnese. So the Greek Revolution is gathered in Epidaurus. They had delegates coming from all over the area, and they voted the constitution. Now this constitution, surprisingly, provided, because the constitution was the product of some very educated Greeks of the diaspora, provided for a budget. The constitution said that the parliament approves at the beginning of each year the hypothetical account. The hypothetical account is the budget of the income and expenses, which is submitted for its approval by the executive. So there was a provision for a budget. This was repeated in the. There were amendments to this constitution during the war, the Revolutionary War. The last constitution was the Constitution of Trezena of 1827. It said that at the beginning of the synod, the house, which is the parliament, because the constitution provided for a parliament, After discussing the hypothetical account of public expenses presented by the government, grants to the government the necessary resources. So there was, there were fiscal institutions. Now, the theory was great, but the practice was not so great because there were not enough revenues to fund the war. So the reference to the budget indicates that the effort to build democratically accounted fiscal institutions was at a similar level as individual rights and safeguarding national independence and so on and so forth. So it's, all right. Now, how was the War of Independence financed? In large part, it was based on the finance of the war was based on the resources of the revolutionary Greeks themselves. They contributed from their own savings. Greeks of the diaspora sent money from abroad. The Philhellenes sent money, but all this was not enough. Okay, because a war effort is a war effort. You have to pay the soldiers. You have to feed them. You have to buy weapons. You have to buy. I mean, it's a very expensive. You know, conducting a war is a very expensive affair. So there were contributions from the ship owners of three important Greek islands, Idras, Spetses, and Sara. Those ship owners contributed financially by making their vessels available to the revolutionaries. Also the peasants of the Peloponnese and central Greece contributed their crops and livestock for the maintenance of the revolutionaries. Now this was not entirely voluntary, because essentially the army would go into a village and would have to eat. So they would take their crops and they would take, but anyway, I mean, this was part of the finance, however. Another source of funding was the spoils from raids and battles. And also the contribution, there was tax revenue. Now, what was the tax revenue during the war? Tax revenue was based on the system used by the Ottomans to tax the Greek farmers when Greece was occupied. So a tenth of the production of every farmer was tax contributed to the administration. Now, this was moved from the Ottomans to the revolutionaries. So part of those resources, of the official resources, were controlled through the Provisional Administration of Greece, which was formed following the Declaration of Greek Independence in 1822. There is a very nice book in Greek by Bouzikis, which discusses in great detail how the War of Independence was financed. Very, very interesting book. Came out a couple of years ago. It's his PhD thesis. But during the revolution, of course, a large part of the existing agricultural and livestock capital of the Greeks was consumed. Most of the infrastructure was destroyed. There is a book by Gallant which claims that more than two-thirds of the olive trees and three-quarters of the vines were destroyed. Three-quarters of the oil mills and flour mills were in ruins. Of the estimated 100,000 sheep and goats before the war, only 10,000 were left at the end of the war. So essentially, the war was an economic devastation as well. However, all this was not enough, and that's why the Greeks turned to capital markets. Somebody said to the provisional administration, oh, we can raise a loan in London. Okay, let's raise a loan in London. So there were essentially two loans of independence. The first was raised in February 1824. The nominal amount at the time of the loan was 800,000 sterling, pound sterling. But the issue price of the bonds was only at 59%. There was a discount. So essentially the amount that Greece would receive for a nominal loan of 800,000 was 472,000 pounds at the time, loans had a fixed coupon rate. The coupon rate was 5%, so the interest rate was, official interest rate was 5% on the 800,000. The maturity was 36 years, the maturity of the loan. But in order to account for the high risk of the loan, the variable that was adjusted was the issue price, the discount. So Greece essentially got a 41% discount for the loan because it was a very high risk loan. So the net amount that was paid to the provisional administration in the end for an obligation of 800,000 pounds was only 350,000 pounds because there were additional charges for the prepayment of interest for 2 years, 16,000 for a sinking fund for amortization, and for commissions there were 23,000. You know, a lot of people made a lot of money out of this loan, obviously. Okay, and it was an onerous loan. There was no way that you could repay 800,000 when you only got 350,000 and you had a war-torn, destroyed economy. Eventually, the amount that reached the administration in the forms of stores and specie, which is specie means money, was only 298,000. So that was the first loan of independence. So obviously, very onerous. And a lot of people in London made money, the financiers made a lot of money out of the commissions and so on and so forth. The second loan was contracted a year after this, a nominal amount of £2 million with an issue price of 55%, an even bigger discount now, 45% discount. So essentially 1,100,000. Again, the coupon rate 5%, the maturity 36%, but a bigger discount, which means that there was a bigger risk now. The net amount to be paid out was only 816, because there were, again, additional charges. And very little reached the administration in the form of weapons and money. Only 242,000. The rest was supposedly used to order some naval ships from Britain and from the United States. They never reached Greece. Only one of them reached Greece. So all this was a major catastrophe. This is how the Greek state started, with these sort of onerous laws. However, politically, it was considered to be very important because it was an indirect way of recognizing the right of Greeks to have a state. So politically, it was considered a big success, although economically, it was a disaster. So Greece could not service, of course, those laws. In April 1826, there was a unilateral postponement of the service, the first default. And the bondholders, the poor people who had bought the bonds, hoping to make a lot of money, lost out. And they said, we're never going to sort of lend to Greece again unless they repay us. The truth is that when the Greek state was created in 1827, between 1827 and 1832, the Kapodistrias administration, which was the first official administration of Greece, tried to come to a negotiation and settle the loan. However, after 1832, with the administration of King Otto did not recognize the laws of independence. So they were pending, and they were settled in 1878. You know, 50 53 years after they were contracted. And so the settlement, because some people say, Greece has never paid its loans. In fact, the settlement of September 1878 was a good settlement for the bondholders, because there was a settlement loan of 1,200,000, a coupon rate of 5%, a maturity of 33 years. Now that 1,200,000 was the amount that roughly Greece had really borrowed at independence. And this was serviced eventually. And it allowed Greece to return to the international capital markets. Okay.
You 15
minutes? Okay, fine. I will not go into the details of all the loans. Now the Ottoman monarchy loan, this is a picture of the revolt of the 3rd of September 1843, yes, against King Otto. King Otto was a monarch without a constitution. And when he arrived in Greece, as I said, his father had negotiated the loan. The administration had difficulty servicing the loan, so there were pay cuts in the public service and so on and so forth, and there was a revolt against King Otto by the military in Athens, and they demanded a constitution, that you cannot serve without a constitution, we want a constitution. And that's a picture which is in the Athens, I think, historical museum in where is the head of the revolution is Kalergis, and King Otto is the guy with the red hat there. So they went, this building was the palace at the time. Now it is the House of Parliament in Greece. And King Otto is, he promised a constitution, he granted the constitution, but he never respected the constitution. Eventually he was ousted. Anyway, what was the loan? That was the guaranteed monarchy loan. It was a much better loan. It was under the guarantee of the power, of the three protecting powers. But again, it could not be serviced. Okay. It was for 60 million French francs. Again, the coupon rate 5%, the maturity 36 years. Now, why do I mention this? Because the fact that it could not be serviced gave a pretext to the British to intervene and stop Otto from inducing revolts in the Ottoman Empire by the Greeks to pursue the grand idea. Now there were two essentially interventions. One was in 1850. In 1850, the British fleet, or a part of the British fleet, blockaded Athens, captured all the Greek fleet, and in order to stop Greece from pursuing the grand idea. Now the pretext was, this was called the Don Pacifico affair. The pretext was that the house of a British subject, Don Pacifico, who was actually Portuguese but was born in Gibraltar, therefore he had the British citizenship, was raided at one point, and Don Pacifico was demanding a big compensation for this raid, and the British used this pretext as well to blockade that. And there was another blockade in 1854. All right. Otto was ousted eventually in 1862. There was a new king, King George, was imposed. He was a Danish prince who agreed to settle the loan of Otto in 1864, and then there were negotiations and the loans of independence were also settled. But between 1843 and 1878, Greece could not borrow internationally because it was excluded from. What did it do? It did not do much. Government expenditure was slashed, there was very low government expenditure, but there were periods of rises in government expenditure around revolts, mainly in Crete. And whenever there was a revolt in Crete, the Greek army would be mobilized, and if you mobilized the army, you had to find money to pay the army. So what happened at that time was that that Greece would borrow small amounts. It is also interesting to see how the exchange rate of the drachma moved during this period. The drachma had a fixed rate to the French franc and to the British pound. Why? Because the drachma was essentially a metallic currency. It had it was a silver-based currency. Britain was a gold-based currency. France was a bimetallic. The French franc was a bimetallic currency. The exchange rate was more or less fixed. But after Greece started increasing its government expenditure to create an army and to pay for infrastructure and borrowing internationally, you see that the drachma was continuously divided. Why? Because the drachma stopped being a metallic currency, it became a paper currency which was not backed by silver or gold. So the Greek governments were issuing a lot of drachmas, and the drachma, the exchange rate of the drachma collapsed until 1895 or something. Okay? All right. Now let us, what happened after the period of borrowing and the default, and there was a war of 1897 where Greece lost to the Ottomans, and the Ottomans almost, you know, captured the whole of Greece. There was again an intervention by the great powers who asked the Ottomans to leave, negotiated a new loan for Greece to pay for its old debts and to compensate the Ottomans, but that was under conditions. The condition was that there was an International Financial Commission imposed in 1898 that was controlling the finances of Greece. Now this was although the International Financial Commission was something that the Greeks obviously did not like, eventually the economy, the public finances were stabilized, the inflation was tackled, and Greece could start borrowing internationally again in the beginning of the 20th century. This time, it borrowed wisely, it built up its army, and it was ready when the Balkan Wars erupted in 1912. Greece had a very well-armed army and a great navy, because Greece had ordered some naval vessels which were among the best at the time. And this helped Greece double its size during the Balkan Wars, because the Balkan Wars were wars that took place for over 2 years, 1912-1913, in the Balkan Peninsula. Essentially, the Ottomans were expelled from Europe, with the exception of Eastern Thrace. And Greece was one of the main winners of this war. Had it not been for the stabilization that was brought about by the International Financial Commission, it is doubtful whether Greece would have been in a position to take advantage of the circumstances. So eventually that stabilization helped Greece double its size. It became, the size of Greece was became roughly the size of Greece of today. This happened during the Balkan Wars. It doubled its size and its population. Then it wanted more and went into Asia Minor, but that was a disaster. Okay? And that was the end of the grand idea. So the stabilization of, by the International Financial Commission helped Greece prepare for this national expansion that took place between 1912 and 1922. Okay. Now, what happened in the first half of the 20th century, and I will stop here, and then I will leave the rest for questions. In the first half of the 20th century, Greece won the Balkan Wars, but after the Balkan Wars, there was a big schism, a national schism between the prime minister, who was very zealous, and the king, King Constantine, over whether Greece should take part in World War I. The protecting powers, Britain and France, wanted Greece to side with the Entente Cordiale, with the side of the British in the First World War. King Constantine was married to the sister of the Kaiser of Germany. And this probably influenced him as well, and he did not want Greece to take part in World War I. He could not argue, of course, that Greece should take part in World War I on the side of Germany, because Britain was always the power that protected Greece in the 19th century. But there was a national schism. Supposedly, King Constantine wanted Greece to be neutral in World War I. What happened in the end was that there was a national schism. There were two governments, one in Athens and one in Salonika, with very zealous. Then the British intervened and ousted Constantine. And Greece took part in the First World War after 1817. The Allies had promised to give it financial assistance, but after Venizelos lost the elections in 1820, this financial assistance never materialized. So like, essentially in the 1920s, when Greece went into the Asia Minor campaign, it was not able to borrow internationally, and it had to rely on the printing press. The army was paid through inflationary sort of paper currency. And that was a period of inflation. Then there was a stabilization, as I said, and followed the Second World War. So let me stop here with some conclusions, though. Two or three minutes for conclusions. You can read the papers if you want. There are many details in the paper, but let me summarize my conclusions. What were the key drivers of the twin deficits? Now, current account deficits were the consequence of two things. First of all, the shortfall of domestic savings relative to investment. Greeks did not have enough money to save. The only exception happened in the 1950s and the 1960s. With regard to fiscal deficits, government deficits, the main driver throughout Greece's modern history have been the occasional military mobilizations and wars because of the pursuit of the grand idea. This was until 1922. Also the two world wars and the civil war were periods where you had big deficits. After the late 1970s, the main driver of fiscal deficits was the attempt to redistribute income and wealth and create a welfare state. So Greece tried to create a welfare state without having enough revenue, by borrowing, initially domestically, then internationally, and that's why the second crisis, the crisis of, the, of 2010, eventually happened. So the drivers were essentially the low savings and the need to spend more than the state could raise in revenue, in tax revenue. What are the implications? When Greece did have access to, did not have access to international borrowing, fiscal imbalances led to monetary destabilization and inflation. When Greece had access to international borrowing, fiscal deficits were generally larger. They led to external deficits and eventually to sovereign debt crisis and defaults. And I have highlighted what this was. And also what mattered was the monetary and the exchange rate regime. When Greece was able to participate in the international regime which stabilized the currency, it could not use inflation so much. When the world monetary system was in chaos, the Greek monetary system was also in chaos. So this is these are essentially our conclusions. And one final conclusion is that if you have deficits in the fiscal accounts, one easy way to reduce them is to stop investment. But if you stop investment, you have low economic growth. So the low economic growth that the Greece had in all its history, apart from the 1950s and the 1960s, was also due to the European deficits. So I will rest my case.
I'm sure there's going to be lots of questions, but let me start with one of my own, if I may, and then we'll open it up to your comments and questions. I guess with the Greek crisis of recent years, one of the dominant themes was whether Greece was a sinner or a victim. And if we think in terms of the 19th century, just focus on the 19th century, then you listed three defaults during that period. And I wonder, possibly in addition to the conditions that you outlined here, whether an essential feature was actually the conditions of the loans being given by Western, by the great powers, was so onerous that in a sense the development of the Greek states was strangled at birth.
This is the case for the loans of independence, that's for sure. The monarchy loan, although was not so onerous, and because the discount was not so big, and then the other loans were essentially at market conditions. So I will not say that the loans were onerous. However, Greece sort of borrowed above its capabilities throughout history. Essentially, it borrowed in periods when financial markets were exuberant, there was a lot of international liquidity, it was easy to borrow in good terms, and bankers wanted to lend to high-risk borrowers because the commissions and the spreads were higher. And they sort of underestimated the risks. And at the end of the day, if there is a default happens under particular conditions. I did not have the time to go into the conditions for a default, but defaults usually happen when there is an international financial crisis. And the conditions change in international financial markets. For example, if there is an international recession, the default of 1893, the default of 1932, and the debt crisis of 2010 happened in the middle of a large international financial crisis, where expectations changed, and those people who were lending very happily changed their expectations, and now they would not lend very happily, and they would ask for their money back. So a default happens usually in difficult financial conditions. The early 1890s was a period of international recession and financial turbulence. 1932 was the Great Depression, and 2010 was also a great recession, if you like. So those three defaults, which were more typical than the defaults of the loans of independence and the other defaults, happened also because international financial conditions changed.
Okay, so the answer to my question is that it's not that they were sinners or victims, but they were internationally vulnerable.
It's like most developing countries.
Yes.
Borrow in foreign exchange. For example, Britain never, when it had to borrow, it borrowed in sterling. The United States, which is a big debtor internationally, borrows in dollars. All other, the Swiss borrow in Swiss francs, and the French in euros, and the German in euros, and in the past in French francs and Deutsche Marks. But developing economies borrow in foreign exchange. Now, is this a big difference? It is. Why? If you borrow in your own currency and you have an outstanding debt, and the bondholders come to you and they say, I want my money back, you go to your central bank and you say, okay, print some money and we're going to pay this fool. But if you have borrowed in foreign exchange, you cannot print the foreign exchange. So if you are a developing country, like in Latin America or Greece or in parts of Europe, which small economies of Europe, you cannot print money to pay the bondholders, which means that you have to find foreign exchange. But in order to find foreign exchange, you have to have a current account surplus or be able to borrow foreign exchange. So this is a phenomenon that is called the original sin of developing economies. That is, they not only borrow, but they borrow in foreign exchange. Whereas the US, which has the highest debt, government debt in the world, even during the financial crisis, could print a lot of dollars and get out of debt.
Okay, if I may, just one quick follow-up. Again, if we focus on, say, the period of the 19th century, I understand your analysis is very clear. There are some very strong structural reasons why a developing economy of that size, with poor savings, inadequate resources, would always have problems in avoiding defaults. Just briefly, to what extent do you think it was also unwise leadership or
it was poor institutions? For example, the tax system in Greece was always very inefficient. So there was not enough regular revenue with which to finance the creation of a state and the investment and so on. So there were structural problems. There was also a lot of optimism. I mean, one of the criticisms against Harilaos Trikoupis was that he borrowed thinking that he could keep borrowing and that eventually Greece would become so developed that it would be able to service the debt. But he did not have enough. I mean, you never have enough time for the development to come. And Harilaos Trikoupis was eventually in the The same with Venizelos. Venizelos also had very ambitious plans, especially in the late 1920s. He borrowed in order to resettle the refugees and to sort of improve Greece's infrastructure. But then the crisis came, and to a certain extent, the same happened with euro area participation, because when Greece entered the euro area, interest rates in Greece fell significantly. And with low interest rates, every Greek started to borrow. And very few Greeks, even in the private sector, would save. So the current account deficit exploded. Greece was borrowing through its government, of course, but it was a lot of this was private debt. And when the crisis came, you don't have enough euros to repay its debt, because the sort of perception at the time was that euro is our own currency, so we're not borrowing in foreign exchange. It turned out that euro was not our own currency. It was the currency of the Germans. So we're essentially borrowing in foreign exchange, because when the crunch came, Greece could not issue euros to repay its debt. It had to borrow the euros.
Okay, I said enough questions. My colleague at the back.
Thank you very much. It was very interesting to listen to you. So the recent years are very different. You outlined these two safety valves. You said, you know, the government, if it borrowed abroad, default. If it borrowed domestically, it could sort of print money, and the result would be inflation. The constraints to doing that now are very different.
Oh, absolutely.
So to what extent can you draw any sort of lessons from the history for what, for the situation?
Now, yes, now the option of printing money does not exist.
Yeah.
It existed in Greece until maybe the late 1980s. After Greece started, you know, following the European rules, it could not print money to find the gap. And now, of course, with the euro, you cannot print euros. Okay. But then, when what happened in the after Greece entered the euro area was that it could borrow easily. And that's why you had the debt crisis. You did not have inflation, but you had the debt crisis. Now you cannot do it. So now you have to sort of tackle the twin deficits somehow. And you have to have low fiscal deficits and low current account deficits if you are not going to destabilize the economy again. So that's the constraints are binding now. And as long as you are part of the euro area, you cannot, again, do what happened even in 2010. Because now people know. People will not lend you on the expectation that you're part of the euro and you cannot default. So the twin deficits have to be tackled.
Okay. There's lots of hands. Can we collect a few?
Sure.
I don't know whether you want to remember.
Okay.
Hi. So you've touched a bit upon it, and it comes back to the question of the professor whether Greece was a sinner or a victim. Is tax revenue, the inefficiency of the tax revenue system after the Second World War, had it been more efficient, could we see these twin deficits be lessened or be lessened to an extent that it would be the problem that you're describing?
Vasily?
Thanks. So I would say that, you know, of course the focus of the analysis on kind of borrowing episodes and defaults, but the twin deficits is more kind of continuing thing. And of course you have a capital account, which, if you want, is the other side of the current account. And in the period, for example, the 50s and 60s, we had a lot of capital inflows, as we did also in the good times before the euro crisis, in the euro. So huge capital inflows. And I want, contrary to the previous question about sort of the fiscal the tax collection system, I want to ask about the investment, because obviously in the cookies or in the pursuit of the great idea, you had investment in infrastructure or investment in the work machine. It was something which was legitimate, one way or the other. In the period in the 50s and 60s, you also had a big investment wave. In the period, let me say, from the 80s until to 2010, we didn't have something equivalent. In the private sector, to some degree, in the 80s, definitely were disinvestment. But there wasn't a big push by the private, by the public sector to compensate for that. So whether this is not a story about defaults and capital markets, but it's a story about, or in the tax system, but it's a story about sort of directing investment, private or public, into productive activities. Simply.
Yes.
Okay.
That's a very good question. I will come back.
Please. Could you say who you are?
Yes. My name is Asori Salasar. I'm at the CIA. So an observation throughout the chronicle was that the most stable periods were a few years before the Balkan Wars, so when there was a linkage to the gold standard, and then in the 50s and the 60s, the reason was part of the Bretton Woods system. So we see a pattern in those two cases of external disciplinary forces substituting for weak institutional capacity domestically. Do you agree with this observation? That's my first question. And second, if we extrapolate this to the years of Eurozone participation, again, we had an external disciplinary force of participation in the Eurozone with no monetary policy autonomy, it was fully controlled and is fully controlled by Frankfurt, but something went wrong, and I wanted you to elaborate on what went wrong institutionally, yeah. Domestic perspective.
To take those three, then
okay, let me take those. Now, the sinner or victim. Let me say that, you know, in retrospect, without the opportunities to borrow internationally, Greece would have been a different country. So, despite the costs of the defaults, you know, all this borrowing and the military mobilizations that were funded and all these things helped Greece grow, and also helped Greece build a welfare state after the 1980s. So it did not all go to waste, okay? However, it was a bumpy road. Now, with regard to capital flows and investment, There were a lot of capital flows in the 19th century too, from the Greek diaspora. But a lot of it did not go to very productive investment. For example, the Greek capitalists of the diaspora gave a lot of money to Greece. They created Zapion and the Olympic Stadium and so on and so forth. But they would not invest in the railroads. They would not invest in the infrastructure. They would invest in commercial activities, whatever was very profitable. The same with the investment that took place after euro area participation, because a lot of the borrowing that Greece sort of contracted after euro area participation went into what is nominally investment. But it was what type of investment? It was essentially real estate, housing. It was not investment that would help repay for a foreign loan. And so the problem is that apart from the tax system, which was clearly, and is still clearly quite inefficient, one of the inefficiencies is that the sectors in Greece which are profitable are sectors which produce non-tradable goods, not exportables, not like real estate, for example. Or the only exception is tourism, which is profitable and brings foreign exchange. So this is also another problem that has been a problem throughout history. It's not a problem just of the 50s and the 60s and the 90s and the 2000s. So investment is a clear issue, and but it matters what type of investment to service foreign currency denominated debt. You need investment in tradables that will create exports and for. Now, what went wrong in the 2000? In essentially, interest rates fell. I mean, I think that the main culprit was that the Greeks, throughout their history, the Greek population, the Greek households and firms, always faced very high interest rates because Greece was a country that had defaulted, had a weak currency, so interest rates were always high. What happened with euro-area participation is that interest rates collapsed. Interest rate collapse means that savings collapsed, because if you're not getting a return on your savings, you're not going to save. And investment and savings collapse means essentially that consumption rose, but also investment rose. But the current account is the difference between savings and investment. So if savings go down and investment goes up, there would be a higher deficit. And how do you fund the deficit? By borrowing internationally. Okay, and if you do it for 10 consecutive years, your external debt is going to balloon, which is what happened in the case of Greece. And also the banking system helped a little bit because many of the Greek bankers say, we had nothing to do with the crisis. We were victims of the crisis. You know, that's baloney. Because what the Greek bankers were doing during the good years was they had government bonds in their portfolios. They gave the government bonds to foreign banks as collateral to borrow in order to fund private loans. And the whole of Greece's debt became external. So the banks also played a role in all this. So essentially this is what went wrong. There was a period of euphoria, which was not warranted. The banks would lend easily to Greece. The Greeks would borrow happily because of low interest rates, and nobody looked at, you know, what is going to happen 10 years from now.
Okay, let's have a last round. Gentlemen, give you?
Yes. Thank you, Professor Featherstone. Yevgeny Skoumas, Professor Adam Skoufi, thank you very much for the well-detailed and interesting presentation. In advertising this seminar, there is an introductory piece that states about the current deficit. The current deficit is there as a consequence of the shortfall in savings and investments. And also, you alluded to that in your conclusion as well. And you also further stipulates that the only exception is the 1950s and 1960s, which I agree entirely with. Now, but would you agree with me that real growth can only take place during a period of reconstruction, following a tragic and calamitous event like the Second World War, for example, and also this would not apply only to Greece but to every nation? That's why the USA was very keen in implementing the Marshall Plan. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions, please?
You talked about the lack of revenue and the inefficiencies. How have those institutions been reformed? Have we seen a gain in efficiency, or is there still a lot of issues on that sense, particularly with parts of the informal economy in Greece, which is kind of notorious for being pretty big? How has that evolved?
Any last question? Please, Kira.
Thank you very much. And following the very interesting discussion that we've been having about the 2000s, So I understand kind of the argument that the interest rates went down, and so savings went down, consumption went up, the current account deficit ballooned. But since the government was borrowing a lot of the money, kind of had a unique kind of opportunity, right, to borrow for cheap internationally, to kind of invest in order to reduce the current account deficit in the future through productive investments, as was said earlier. So why was it so hard for Greece to make use of that opportunity?
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
The role of the government. It was not. All right. So I agree that it is easier to grow after your economy has been destroyed. But the Greek economic miracle of the 50s and the 60s was not just because Greece started from a very low point. It also was one of the few periods when Greece had a very stable currency by tying the drachma to the dollar in 1953 after a devaluation which was 50%. So Greece was very competitive at the time. It did not have problems of the current account because of it was competitive. And also for fiscal policy, there was a rule that budget deficits should be zero, apart from investment debt, the investment budget. So Greece had fiscal rules at that time and monetary rules that were conducive to a stable outlook and a stable economy. And that was also part of the miracle. Because Greece, for 20 years, had growth rates of 7% per annum, which is amazing. That's amazing. Never since then. Now, the reforms, obviously, Greek governments have a lot to do with why the economy is not doing well, because essentially, in democratic periods, like after 1974, but also in many other periods in history, reforms, the Greek governments did not pursue reforms as they should have done because of the political obstacles to reform. Reforms usually have long-term benefits, but short-term costs. And since the outlook of most governments is relatively short, Greek governments, at least since 1974, have not been reformist. And that's why the tax system still has problems, and the economy still has problems, and many reforms like the ones that Chris Pissarides will talk about on Thursday have not been pursued. And finally, the role of the government in the crisis. Greek governments in the after euro area participation, essentially since 2000, fiscal deficits increased because Greek governments could also borrow quite easily and quite cheaply. So the incentives for the government was not to raise taxes, but to borrow. So the same incentives that apply to the private sector also apply to the governments. But if you look at the data, compared to the 1980s and the 1990s, fiscal deficits in Greece, with the exception of 2009, which was a year of international recession, etc., were not much higher on average. Whereas if you look at what the private sector did in the after euro area participation, the private sector debt rose much more quickly than government. I mean, the private sector debt in Greece in 1999 was about 60% of GDP. In 2009, it was 160% of GDP. So it rose excessively. It was mainly the rise in the public sector, in the private sector debt, and not the public sector debt that accounted for the rise in the
Okay, before I ask you to thank our speaker, let me mention two upcoming events. I've said previously that throughout the academic year, every 2 weeks on a Tuesday evening, we would normally have a research seminar and speakers on many different topics to do with contemporary Greece. we hope that we will see many of you at future events. Let me mention two upcoming events. One of them is very soon. It's this Thursday, and it is with Professor Sir Christopher Pissarides, the Regius Professor of Economics here at the LSE, Nobel Prize winner. He headed what has become known as the Pissarides Commission, involving the inputs of a number of very senior economists, bringing forward a report as to what kind of structural reform Greece needs in order to be on a better growth path. So, with Greece having elections and a new government, we've invited Chris Pissarides to come and talk about what the new government should be focusing on and how to enable the structural reforms of the Pissarides Commission. So this Thursday at 6:30, not 6 o'clock, and I believe that's in the Sheikh Zayed Theatre. It is, isn't it? Sheikh Zayed Theatre, 6:30 this Thursday. Chris Pissarides is talking about his commission, and we've prevailed upon George to be the discussant in response to what Chris has got to say, and my colleague Vasilis will chair that session. This November sees the 50th anniversary, one of the most formative experiences in modern, in contemporary Greek history. The so-called student uprising of the Polytechnic in Greece, George's institution, became hugely symbolic perhaps more than substantive in terms of the demise of the Colonel's Junta regime the following July 1974. And November 17th, tanks went in, and some students killed, and the uprising was suppressed by the junta. November the 17th, a date which became known in other respects as well, as with the terrorist organization in Greece. On the eve of that collapse of the student uprising, on November the 16th, we'll have a panel discussion about the significance of the Polytechnia uprising, the extent to which the events also formed a formative experience for the, what has become known as the Polytechnic generation, those who matured politically in this period. So 50 years ago, your peers were involved in one of the most significant events of contemporary Greek history. So do please come along to that on the 16th of November for a discussion about what's actually happened with people who were present, as well as a discussion of its historical significance. But also, we will have other events this term, and we would hope to be able to announce those on our website very shortly, including some significant public lectures. This evening, we've got off to a tremendously good start with our seminars, and we've had a very expert overview about the economic development of the Greek state and the constraints therein. So please join me in thanking Professor George Alagoustakis.